It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, members of Congress are preparing to head back to Washington after their annual August break. What can and should be accomplished, and are we heading for another budget showdown? I'll talk with Arizona's Congressman David Schweikert. Also, a panel at ASU will be exploring U.S. relationships with certain Central American nations and what that could teach us about why tens of thousands of unaccompanied minors crossed illegally into the U.S. earlier this summer. Plus, Phoenix College is considering a task force recommendation that it eliminate its football program. How important is the athletic department at a community college? We'll discuss that. And Daniel Hernandez, who's credited with helping save the life of Gabrielle Giffords when she was shot in 2007, is now the subject of a play. I'll talk with the playwright Guillermo Reyes. We start today's program with the reaction of a large credit rating agency to the results of Arizona's primary election in the race for two seats on the Corporation Commission. In today's Arizona Republic and online at azcentral.com, reporter Ryan Randazzo wrote about how investment analysts at Moody's view the wins by Tom Farese and Doug Little on the Republican side. And Ryan joins me now. Good morning.
Morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So, Ryan, what was Moody's specifically focused on?
Well, they basically said that this was positive, that those two Republicans won the primary, that was positive for the credit rating of Arizona Public Service Company's parent company, Pinnacle West Capital.
Does Moody's have a particular ideological bent any more than any other brokerage might?
I would assume they're just looking at the risk of lending that company money for big projects that it might embark on, like big transmission lines or power plants. So,
if you're not someone who owns shares of Pinnacle West, Ryan, how should you react to the Moody's assessment?
Well, if you're a customer of APS, I think you would be interested in that. Mm-hmm. It's positive for the company, and that could be viewed two ways. One, you obviously want your utility company to be stable. You don't want a utility company that goes bankrupt. But if you're someone considering solar, you could look at the flip side of this rating and say, well, if it's good for APS and they're at odds with the solar leasing companies right now, then this is probably not good for the prospects of solar in that utility's territory.
I wonder how much this complicates things in the sense that the assessment is measuring what's good for shareholders, but not necessarily consumers. You sort of address that, but I think in the whole big picture, when people hear about this involvement perhaps of APS when it comes to funneling some money for support of Farese and Little, for example, is this a tough sell for consumers to figure out where should we stand on this based on what Moody's says, based on what ads we're seeing, et cetera? It's a pretty complicated situation, isn't it?
It certainly is, because we all pay bills to the utility. And so when you look at this and say, well, Wall Street likes what's happening here, that means they expect the utility to make more money. That doesn't necessarily sound good if you're paying the bills to that utility. Mm-hmm. It makes it sound as though you're going to continue paying higher bills. So the one twist in that is that you probably would pay much higher bills if the company were to have real financial issues because of some sort of regulatory decision that went against the company.
So what are Moody's analysts saying about Farese and Little's chances in the general election?
Well, conventional wisdom is that the Republicans are likely to defeat the two Democrats running in the general election. Moody's has said that UBS, which looked more at Pinnacle West stock and came to the same conclusion that Farese and Little would be better for the shareholders of Pinnacle West. They also predict that the Republicans should defeat Sandra Kennedy and Jim Holloway in the general election.
When we think about the registration advantage that Republicans have in Arizona, which is pretty sizable, obviously people factor in independents, but we're never sure which way independents will vote, if they will vote. What advantages, other than that, do Farese and Little have? Because Sandra Kennedy was elected once as a commissioner, and yet she doesn't seem to have built up any momentum coming from that.
No, and I think what's going to be important in the general election is which way some of these Republican voters are going to break, because in the primary, you had two Republicans who supported the solar industry. They got support from the solar industry, and while they lost, if a number of those voters break for the Democrats, who are viewed as much more solar-friendly than Farese and Little, it could be an interesting race. Most people don't think that's what's going to happen. For one, Farese and Little benefited from more than $1 million in independent spending in the primary. Some of that's going to trickle over because they are very well-known names at this point because of all the advertising. And as you mentioned, Kennedy just hasn't picked up a lot of steam. Part of that is because the Democrats didn't have any opponents in the primary, so there wasn't a lot of attention on their race.
Ryan, I apologize for saving the 800-pound gorilla to the end of this conversation, but we keep hearing from very reputable people about APS involvement in directing money in favor of Farese and Little. Based on all the reporting you've done, people you've talked to, do you have any doubts about that? I mean, do you feel very confident that that is the case?
I feel highly confident that that's the case, just from the answers that I've gotten from APS. For one, they won't deny that they're doing it. And then they made their answer a little more clear and said that they will counter the messaging that comes from Tusk, which is the rooftop solar industry. So they said they will get involved to counter the messaging of Tusk. Tusk supported two of the Republicans who lost in the primary. So I have a high level of confidence that APS is working in the election. They just won't say how much and for who, but I think it's pretty apparent from the way they've answered that question multiple times when they've been asked.
And very briefly, this seems like a real change in tactics for APS, doesn't it?
It does, but they also are facing a rooftop solar industry that's been pretty aggressive in characterizing APS as a big evil utility. So it's a change in tactics from their part, but they're also facing sort of a different kind of media warfare, if you will.
Ryan Randazzo of the Arizona Republican, azcentral.com. You can follow him on Twitter at @utilityreporter. Ryan, thanks as always.
Have a good day.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Congress is in the midst of its annual recess, which ends next week when House and Senate members head back to Washington from their home districts. Before he goes back to the nation's capital, Arizona's 6th District Congressman, Republican David Schweikert, agreed to join us on the program. Welcome back.
This is always a lot of fun.
So how have you been spending your recess?
Combination of a number of things. We've been out in other parts of the country helping elect fellow members, helping them raise some money, helping them tell their stories. On a couple occasions, we had some first-time candidates that we helped them sort of organize. So that's sort of the political side. I start almost every morning with a couple coffees with folks from around the district, and it's fascinating. You know, sometimes you have someone that wants to start a business, and they have something very technical that they're worried about, down to someone that had an amazing story of what had happened to her father at the VA. So you do that sort of every morning. It's just sort of a way to sort of make sure you're staying in the rhythm of your constituencies. And then other little externalities to keep sane. My wife has been helping me rewire part of my house to low voltage LED lighting. So, you know, we all have hobbies.
The president gets a lot of criticism for going out and playing golf. So I wonder, when people hear Congress is taking a recess, with all the big issues facing it, this seems like a long recess to a lot of people. Why isn't it?
It's a combination of, I think, the differences, what the different branches of government really do. If you're a member of the House, you're up every 2 years. But you're also, there's a reason it's referred to as the People's House. You know, those relationships, those coffees, are incredible sort of relationship-building intel of the needs and concerns of your constituency. That's very different than being the executive, where you're also the commander-in-chief, and much of the world is looking at every single thing you do.
In this world of conflict, when you have some of these coffees, are you hearing from people who are not always thrilled with the job you're doing?
What you hear is great concern, but often the amount of information is fairly narrow. And I mean this with all the love I can say it, is we often know what we know, but we don't know what we don't know.
And that sounds too Rumsfeldian for a lot of listeners,
But a good example is a couple days ago, sat down with a group who are, you know, very pro-Israel, very concerned. They have absolutely legitimate issues, and they know the core of their issue incredibly well. But the other externalities of what are the threats to Jordan? What's the threats in Syria? What's actually happening in the Balkans? How is Russia playing? And you start to realize how much of what's going on in foreign policy right now is interlinked. But you and I, when we turn on our nightly news, we're just getting one sliver of a very complex story.
We have to come back to foreign policy. Obviously, it's in the news everywhere. But because you're a budget guy, not to stereotype you, but...
No, I'm okay with that.
Okay. So recent estimates from the Congressional Budget Office indicate over the next decade, healthcare, Social Security, interest on the debt will eat up 85% of all new government spending. And at the same time, spending on national defense, transportation, among other things, will be at their lowest levels, at least as a share of the economy, since before World War II. So what should Congress be doing about this, considering if you upend the entire system, you're going to hurt a lot of people?
Well, look, you and I have had this conversation actually now for years. So for the listeners, you should see us both grinning, because this is something I actually believe the greatest issue of our times is how do we deal with our mandatory spending? You know, our social entitlement promises that have been made. And in many ways, this is far beyond a Republican, Democrat, left-right paradigm. We have something called the baby boomers. They've begun retiring. Think of this. In 9 budget years, only 24% of the budget will be something I go and vote on. Think of that. In 9 budget years, 24% will be what we call discretionary. That's the military. Mm-hmm. That's your parks. That's, you know, your health research. That's education. And everything else is being consumed by Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the new health care benefits in Obamacare, interest on the debt, and other sort of promises we've paid in pensions. Just to give you the scale, we've actually had generals in my office saying that in 9 budget years, 80% of the military, or 80% of the Army will be health care, salaries, pension. This is the single biggest issue, sort of holistically for the government. How do we prepare for what's coming at us with the social entitlement costs?
Well, exactly. So when you're taking steps to move forward with that, and I sort of put this on the tail of my prior question, which is how do you change the system without completely upending it, and then it becomes a right versus left where, okay, we're providing too much for these people who need it, and then we're overspending in this area. It seems like you know what the questions are.
Yeah.
Are not enough of your fellow members knowing what the answers are?
Well, until the politics, until you're a candidate, or either Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, whatever you are, running for federal office, the question to you is, how will you save Medicare? Mm. How will you save Social Security? How will you handle the pension entitlement costs? And right now, those of us who are running for Congress, we find ourselves not running on those issues. You know, we talk about other externalities. We talk about things that, in many ways, we may even have no influence on as a member of Congress. But that's the hot button issue of the day. It's what's being talked about on the radio. It's what's in the newspaper. That's what drives voters, because these things that have huge numbers attached to them, they're uncomfortable to think about. Mm-hmm. They're difficult, but we have to do it. Look, last January, a university group and others came out with believing that if we did gap accounting, the unfunded liabilities of the United States are now at $205 trillion. That is greater than many of the estimates of the wealth of the world. Mm. It's difficult, but I will make the argument that that debt, unfunded liabilities, will now drive all public policy in the future.
Arizona's 6th District Congressman, Republican David Schweikert, will continue our conversation on Here and Now. Plus, a little bit later on this hour, we'll find out about the plight of unaccompanied minors who crossed into the U.S. illegally. Stay tuned.
Nine out of 10 Americans want companies to tell them the ways they are supporting causes. Corporate sponsorship of KJZZ shares your support of accurate, in-depth journalism with a thoughtful, engaged audience. More at sponsorship.kjzz.org.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Checking temperatures around the state right now. Sunny skies and 76 degrees in Flagstaff. It's 83 in Prescott. Sunny and 77 up at the Grand Canyon. Sunny and 94 in Tucson. 97 degrees in Casa Grande and 99 in Yuma. Stay with us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for NewsHour from the BBC. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Mr. Jim Seward and Ms. Julie Karsis, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. Mostly sunny skies and 99 degrees in Phoenix at 1121.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, continuing the conversation with Arizona's 6th District Congressman, David Schweikert. We're talking about budget. Let's continue with that. Are we headed for another one of these headline-grabbing budget standoffs, 11th-hour negotiations, we finally get stuff done? Should we be concerned about that?
I think you're always concerned about it, but I don't see the type of political theater coming. Now, what does concern me a bit is if we are walking into having to do a continuing resolution, because ultimately we have a number of budget bills that just go nowhere once they hit the Senate. And does the Senate leadership think that engaging in some pretty hard-fought political battle over spending helps the chances of the left retaining the U.S. Senate? And so it's one of those... Let's face it, what's going to happen over the next couple of months, it's all about the November election.
Mm-hmm. So who is helped by political theater? Are incumbents helped by that?
Well, you sometimes don't know. There's the law of unintended consequences. Think about this. Let's go back about a year ago when we went through some of the political dance of the House trying to be able to move certain changes to the new health care law, mm-hmm. to Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And we had the government slow down for a couple of weeks. The world was going to come to an end. That Republican was never going to be elected again. Republicans' numbers fell through the floor. 6 weeks later, the rollout of the new health care law crashes and burns, and many of the very things we were all talking about in the government slowdown actually happened, and all of a sudden we looked like really smart. You really don't know the future. And, you know, the arrogance of Washington, and let's face it, a lot of the folks that observe it, is somehow we think we know what tomorrow's going to bring, and we don't.
So grand bargain, this is getting to be a couple of years ago now, when House Speaker Boehner and President Obama had these private discussions with some of their staffs. First of all, is a grand bargain possible, and would you like a grand bargain? Or, because one of the things that always comes up is, will Democrats agree to cut spending, and will Republicans ever agree to raise taxes? And as an addendum to that, do you believe in there is such a thing as temporary tax?
I believe there's actually ways to get a grand bargain. My instinct is it would have to happen in probably lame duck, because we have a number of folks who believe it would be a career ender, or it's very hard to sort of explain the mechanics. But remember, we right now have a federal government. It's taking in more revenues than any time in history. We actually, what was it, a year and a half ago, did... You know, those big tax hikes, you know, the rollout, some people like to call it the expiring of the Bush tax cuts. It's much more complicated than that. So revenues are higher than they've ever been in history. What we have is the more difficult discussion of the vast majority of our spending is on autopilot. It's a formula. Mm. And we're about to start to see the first cascade effect of what many of us have been talking about. Think of this. In 2 years, Social Security disability, the trust fund is gone. And it's going to be about, depending on new signups, about a 19% to 21%, 22% cut to folks who are receiving Social Security disability. And this is happening in 2016. It's just around the corner. And that's sort of the first domino to start falling on what we're discussing, that the trust funds are crashing as, you know, baby boomers are beginning to retire. Are we going to step up? There's ways to do this. A simple example, Social Security, it's the third rail. You know, when I stand up and talk about it in town halls and budget meetings, you have the group there videotaping you, and they're going to use it as their attack ad. But if you're trying to save the system, having an honest conversation of there's actually a little smorgasbord, to use a word, of things you could do as a combination to put it together to make it safe and solvent beyond the demographic bubble. And those are hard conversations to have. But once again, I'll make you the argument they're the most important ones we should be having.
Does leadership want to have those conversations? I don't want to let you off the hook.
No.
But I do feel like when leadership decides what to do in the House and Senate, are they driven by what their body tells them, or are they saying they're looking more strategically and looking to get positive headlines?
Look, right now, and this is going to sound a little bit like a partisan shot, but it's not. And I believe many of my friends on the left would agree. We have a White House that is very political. You know, that they're from a sort of a political view of the world, not a policy view. And remember, policy and politics are two very different things. And think about how close we came to the grand bargain. Mm-hmm. And if you read Woodward's book and go through, you know, and having lived it, you know, having been there, it really sort of helped an understanding. Boehner was ready to fall on his sword there at the end, and it was like Lucy with the football. You know, they get to the deal, and then some of the staff at the White House would say, well, that doesn't good for us politically, pull the football.
But yeah, but would Boehner have been able to get this through, or would he have been hung in effigy by his members?
No, because if it actually helped us save entitlements instead of the, you know, the math is the math. It's coming at us. I believe the votes are not only there. I think you'd be surprised how many of those on the conservative side are willing to come up with a series of combinations to make this all mathematically work.
So since you just said politics and policy are different, so leaving politics aside, why shouldn't President Obama take executive action on immigration?
Well, first off, I don't think he has legal authority.
Okay.
I mean, you know, there are those things called the Constitution and laws. But let's actually take one step backwards and say, if you are someone who is a big advocate of broad-scale immigration reform.
Like the Gang of Eight in the Senate.
I'll even go a step forward. Let's actually take some of our activists that are here in our community.
Okay.
Understand, if the president does some type of executive action, you know, beyond the arguments whether he has the authority or not, understand the cascade effect that's going to come in. It's not the law of unintended consequences. How many people from around the world will be coming screaming towards our border because of the perception that if I can get there and manufacture some documents and some utility bills for my cousin, I might be able to demonstrate that I qualify. And there's a lot of reports and narratives we've seen that this is one of the things that happened to us with the unaccompanied minors, is there was a perception that DACA, the deferred action, created incentives. And if you believe, you know, human nature operates on incentives and disincentives, this is actually an opportunity to move from playing your political base, which I believe the president is sort of doing, and now he's up against the problem of he has some red state U.S. senators that are in tough races, so they're playing politics on this. The ability to move towards a policy on immigration that actually does what we were just talking about. If the greatest threat to my society right now is how do I pay for my promises, I need economic growth. I need to be up there in the 3.5-4%. I need to hold it for a decade plus. Every policy we engage in, whether it be our environmental policy, our tax policy, our immigration policy, needs to be wrapped around the mantra of what maximizes economic growth in the economy.
Less than a minute to go, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about immigration reform, because of the economic effect. But is there any aspect of immigration reform you'd support?
But first off, you have to back up and say, what model? Hmm. Do you want to adopt a model that's similar to what actually the rest of the industrialized world has adopted, whether it be Australia, Great Britain, New Zealand, Canada, which is substantially a talent-based, an economic, an entrepreneurial-based system. And the beauty of that system doesn't say what country you come from, what religion you have, what ethnicity, what color your skin is. It's absolutely blind to those. It's about the talents you bring. And we're, I believe, almost the only industrialized country that still has a familial, a chain migration, sort of lottery-type system. Mm. It might be time we move to this side of the century and do something much more modern.
Arizona's 6th District Congressman, Republican David Schweikert, thank you.
I'll always enjoy this.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Earlier this summer, thousands of unaccompanied minors crossed the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas. Many of them were put on buses and shipped to other parts of the U.S., including Arizona, and were held at a number of locations like Nogales. Yesterday, an inspector general's report was made public. A federal investigation that included surprise inspections was unable to substantiate 16 accusations by advocacy groups that the government packed into frigid cells children caught crossing the border alone, while also making them sleep on hard floors and providing inadequate food and medical care. Other claims about treatment of the children are still under review, according to the Homeland Security Department. Later today on Arizona State's Tempe campus, as part of Beyond the Border, a panel will consider migrants or refugees, the crisis in Central America, and the response in the United States. With me are moderator Leah Surratt of the Religious Studies Department and Professor Evelyn Cruz of the O'Connor College of Law. Leah, what are you hoping the panel touches on?
I decided to put together this panel because I am an assistant professor of religious studies at ASU, whose work focuses on migration, and also because I'm involved locally with a group called the Phoenix Restoration Project, which provides humanitarian outreach to those who are in immigration detention and those who've recently been released. And the idea for this panel came to me because over the summer, like many people in Phoenix, I was deeply concerned during that period from late May to early June, when we witnessed what we're estimating to be about 1,000 individuals released to the Phoenix Greyhound Station who had been held in detention facilities, rather in holding facilities. And they were mostly women and children. During that time, I witnessed a huge outpouring of support from the community. We were flooded with donations. To this day, we still have donations of water that were brought to help those women, especially the ones with young children during that time. So I just witnessed such an enormous interest from the community and involvement, mobilization from people who otherwise may have been not too involved in migration studies or issues per se. But at the same time, I witnessed a lack of deeper understanding about the situation in Central America from all of us who are seeking to provide that humanitarian aid. Now that the media attention, the spotlight is no longer on Phoenix, I thought it was time for us to sort of regroup and to come together, bring together the activist and the scholarly communities in a more sustained conversation about this issue.
Evelyn, what are the most important, before we get into some specifics, what are the most important legal questions as it relates especially to the unaccompanied minors? What are some basic facts that people listening right now need to know about representation of the kids, what rights they have once they come into the U.S.?
Well, the United States considers the process of immigration to be a civil matter. So you do not have a right to an appointed attorney, which makes it very difficult for these children who do not have perhaps contacts in the United States as to how to obtain representation. A number of clinics out of universities throughout the country and nonprofits have been trying to step up to the plate to assist these children. And that's an ongoing situation, because even though they might not be in Nogales any longer, they are now in other places throughout the United States in pretty large groups and in need of assistance.
Mm-hmm. And you've had a great deal of involvement in this for a number of years. What stands out to you about the idea that now this generated headlines? Because obviously you were someone who was involved in this long before it became something that people were seeing on the nightly news.
Correct. I've been representing children in the system since 2005. It is a crisis in the sense that we have a large number of individuals, but it's a crisis that you can explain by looking at the history that we've been observing over the last few years. The growth in gang activity in Central America has created unnecessary flight by individuals in those countries, children who are mutilated and killed at the age of 11. For not wanting to join the gangs, their parents are seeing a necessity to send them to another country, and even though they may already understand that there are awful perils on the road. So that has been increasing over the years. And the tipping point has reached that level that we are facing a large exodus.
Leah, how important is it to discuss that tipping point, this idea of why, and getting people to understand of knowing why, for a lot of people, tipping point, perfect storm, however they wanted to phrase it?
I think it's absolutely important for us to discuss this now, and also to, you know, to think critically about the notion of crisis and some of the alarmist responses that can generate, but also we need to take stock and consider what we can do to proceed more intelligently in the future.
Mm-hmm. Where do intelligence and empathy or humanity, where do those cross? I mean, it's not always as easy as we'd like it to seem, right, especially with an issue like this.
I think for many people, it's easy, and this is a good thing. I wouldn't want to deny it. It's easy to see a child in need and to hand them formula or a diaper, right? That is immediate. There's no question. You do that, right? But I think where those can cross in a productive way is when that leads to a deeper questioning. How is the humanity of this person connected to larger structural issues in which I'm implicated and their country is implicated? When that can push into those structural questions, right? And we can realize that just because we are members of one country doesn't necessarily mean that our duty to others stops at our borders.
And to that extent, one of the things that I hope to talk about in our presentation later on today is about the historical tipping points that we have seen where we have had large immigrant populations facing situations that are humanitarian crisis, mm-hmm. and how we have dealt with them and what we should have learned from those events to put us into a better perspective of how to address the situation here. We had the Marielito boat lift in the 1980s out of Cuba. We've had situations after World War II, and also we had the Croatian situation back in the 1990s. So we've had a number of examples of how we have faced these situations and how our country has done good things and bad things dealing with those issues.
How much more complicated does this all become when we're dealing with children?
Well, we have had some successes and failures at realizing the needs of children. During World War II, we turned away orphans, and unfortunately, many of them died in the seas. In the 1990s, rather, we had the Elian Gonzalez situation and the rally as to whether or not we should step forth and decide that this child should remain in the United States. So there are a number of examples throughout our history of how we have put forth that question. It is difficult when you're dealing with children because you are looking at not just a human being, but a potential of someone who may come up to be someone more influential in society, but at the age that they're at, they're very quiet and non-impressive, I guess, to some people. But at the same time, it is the understanding that as a sovereign nation, we do have to have parameters, and those have to be evaluated and decided in a way that meets our needs, but at the same time our obligations to the human race.
As an attorney and a law professor, how do you have that cross-section of this is what the law says, and then where does empathy fit in there?
The law that we have is an evolving law. To some extent, when we first started the issues relating to protecting individuals in fear of being returned to their home country, our one concentration was individuals who fear attacks because of their political views. We saw that as a very strong pool that we wanted to protect. Slowly, we have increased our involvement in protecting individuals that belong to certain races or groups, or have a desire to practice their religion in freedom. And so that has taken time to evolve. So to me, the question of how to merge law with the ethics is something that is a continuous conversation. I can't say, well, here's the law and we're done with it. It's here's the law. Is it working for the realities that we have in our current condition in a world that is interconnected mm-hmm. and interrelated and interdependent? Is there something that we can change to improve, looking back at what we have done in the past and learning lessons from that?
Leah, what are some other topics you're planning to bring up?
Because this is being sponsored by the School of History, Philosophy, and Religious Studies, we have the humanities angle, and we're going to be bringing in a philosopher who will be speaking more in a more general sense to some of the ethics underlying different perspectives on borders, on open borders, and also on the humanitarian obligations of governments in the face of crises. So we'll be drawing into some comparison to the response after Katrina, for example, and how we might learn some lessons now to respond to an international situation today.
I would think this idea that we're past the heat of the moment is a good thing in the sense that now it's not all over the headlines and now people can actually sit back and have a productive discussion about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think during the time it was very busy, it was difficult for the community to gather forces because each statement that was made caused a great deal of outcry in the public on the airwaves. So right now it's really great that we have the opportunity to continue. And I don't want to say that the problem is past. I think there's a lot we need to work on, and we need to continue to work on that momentum to have a conversation. Yeah.
Evelyn, Leah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Leah Surratt is the moderator, and Evelyn Cruz is one of the panelists for the discussion, Migrants or Refugees, the Crisis in Central America and the Response in the United States. It's taking place in just a little bit, today at noon, in the Pima Auditorium on ASU's Tempe campus.
KJZZ is supported by High Health, announcing Kaleidoscope Collection, Vibrant Health Simplified, 9 nutrition packs customized for your lifestyle. Health options like Kaleidoscope Collection available only at High Health or highhealth.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Look for sunny skies in the valley today and a high near 108 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy tomorrow with a high of 105 and more of the same for the latter part of the week. Partly cloudy around the valley with highs of 104 on Friday and 102 on Saturday. Join us at 12 o'clock for Here and Now from Boston. As drought worsens, California is increasingly turning to groundwater to fill the gap. We'll hear about why some experts say groundwater shouldn't be used as a primary source of water. And prospects for a peace plan in Ukraine. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. Mostly sunny skies, and it's 99 degrees right now in Phoenix at 11:42.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Phoenix College has a long athletic tradition full of legendary coaches and a number of players who've gone into some professional success. But the cost of athletics, the football program in particular, led a task force to recommend eliminating the team. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with the executive director of the National Junior College Athletic Association. I'm now joined by Arizona Republic columnist Paula Bovin, who devoted some of her Sunday column to the Phoenix College situation. Hi, Paula. Good morning.
Good morning.
You were able to read an internal email, printed a bit of it in your Sunday column. Give us a little background. Who's recommending the Phoenix College eliminate football, and what are the reasons?
Well, there was a sort of a task force, put together by the Maricopa County Community Colleges, the district, and it was really put together to take a look at universities or the colleges, junior colleges. What is it maybe that needs to be cut? How can we use our money better? It wasn't out intending to do anything with sports, but as is often in the sort of the realm of the sports world, sports doesn't always make money. And so when you're looking at it from a simple dollar sense kind of viewpoint, you're going to find that maybe there isn't a great return in the ledger when you're putting the ledger together. And so there were people, the steering committee, when they looked at that, thought, you know what, this isn't helping Phoenix College. They're losing money on athletics. Let's make this recommendation.
We reached out to Phoenix College President Anna Solly for an interview. We were told she's still kind of gathering the information. Have you heard anything about whether this could go forward or whether it's a non-starter?
No, from what I've heard, her initial viewpoint is that she was very much against it, and this was sort of put together from a group that she wasn't involved with. Now, I think she's going to open it up in sort of a public forum and listen to people and hear what others think about it. But my sense is the cuts won't happen because I think she has the final say, certainly at Phoenix College, and everything I heard, she's not going to let it pass. So that's kind of my gut feeling is right now that's what will happen.
Letter to the editor in the Republic this morning, someone who seems to think it would be a good idea for Phoenix College to get rid of the program. Have you gotten a lot of response? And if so, what's it been, yes or no?
You know, I would say every response I've gotten, and maybe it is because I'm a sports writer, people were very much against it. And the people I was hearing from were people that are involved with Phoenix College or were part of the athletic circle years and years ago. You know, it produced more in the past than now, but it produced a lot of athletes that went on to college, some that went on to the NFL, some that played professional baseball, because the reality is not every student athlete that comes out of college is ready for a four-year university. And the community college system does a great job for athletes who have that interest in athletics but still need a little guidance academically. So the people I was hearing from were those who lived those situations and parents of children who had gone through that, who are just so grateful that their daughter got to play golf at Phoenix College because now she has a four-year scholarship elsewhere.
Yeah, Paul, and maybe I'm focused too much on the so-called major sports, but there's reputation still sometimes for some junior colleges. Arizona State's football team had a couple of players they were going to rely on this season who didn't, I guess, cut it academically. I want to make sure I'm accurate about that.
Sure.
And so is there still that reputation that some junior colleges have that it's almost like an athlete factory to make guys ready and more mature, in most cases guys, more mature for the next level?
There's still still some of that, but the reality is, because of the college system in general and the cost of universities, you're seeing more students go to community colleges just so they can afford, and these even include athletes maybe who wouldn't get a scholarship, will go to community colleges before they go to the major colleges. Your ASU's basketball program is going to benefit greatly this season from a couple of junior college players, as they did last year. It's a great sort of way for coaches who have immediate needs to fill needs that maybe a freshman couldn't. So, yeah, there is still a bit of that reputation with community colleges, and that the athletes who go there are maybe not academically meeting standards. But it's not necessarily because they're not smart or because they didn't study. Some just sort of need to learn the process of preparing for education, and maybe didn't have the right guidance in high school. And now that they're a little more mature, as 18 and 19-year-olds versus 14 and 15-year-olds, you're making better decisions about academics. So I think people are finding that as well.
Arizona Republic sports columnist Paula Bovin. Paula, thank you.
Thank you.
KJZZ is a part of Rio Salado College, which, like Phoenix College, is part of the Maricopa County Community College District. Major college sports, especially a so-called Big Five of conferences, may end up compensating student-athletes. Many have argued that billion-dollar television contracts benefiting universities and conferences are directly attributable to the talents of the student-athletes on the court or on the field. But what about junior and community colleges? What impact do they have? Mary Ellen Light is Executive Director of the National Junior College Athletic Association. Mary Ellen, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Steve. Great to be here.
Well, can you give us some basics, first of all? How many colleges are in the NJCAA?
We have approximately 520 member colleges, which about 60,000 student-athletes make up the NJCAA.
I suppose it's hard to lump colleges together. In a general sense, how are they doing financially, academically?
You know what? I think our colleges are doing quite well. You know, obviously the economy was difficult for everyone over the past 5 years. We've had some ups and downs. Some colleges who have looked at different programs, very much like what Phoenix is doing, and deciding what sports really they want to keep. But by and large, our colleges have fared fairly well.
Do junior colleges have special challenges in balancing academics and athletics, because in many cases the student athletes are only going to be there for a couple of years as opposed to potentially four or five?
Sure. And you know, a lot of our colleges, when you talk about NJCAA colleges, there's such a wide variety of institutions. You know, we have Miami-Dade College, who has about 50,000 students, down to some of our smaller colleges that might only have 800 or so, anywhere from metropolitan to rural and everywhere in between, as well as those who can offer full rides and those who play Division II and those who offer no scholarships at all. So we really do have a wide variety of schools that we're talking about there. So, you know, when we're looking at programs and trying to assess you know, what's right for them, it's really difficult to kind of lump them all together and have them make a statement that fits all of them in one fell swoop.
Well, absolutely. For people who don't think about this, or who may watch the major college football on Saturday afternoons, or now I guess it's on almost every day of the week, how different are junior college athletics from the big colleges and universities? Obviously there are some basic differences, but what are some interesting differences that people may not think about too often?
Well, again, our student-athletes, the NCAA, when you're talking about some of those really major conferences, you know, you're talking about student-athletes who are read through those programs. Their days are programmed for them, and they eat and sleep, and they go to class, and they have tutors, and they have everything provided to them to help them succeed academically and athletically. Within the NJCAA, you know, again, our programs are very varied, but our student-athletes are working. Some of them are trying to raise a family. Some, you know, have different challenges, whether it be financial or their home lives and those kind of things. So, you know, a lot of times our students are facing some decisions and some challenges that maybe some of those four-year college programs have eliminated for them, in terms of, you know, how are they going to put food on the table, how are they going to support their family, you know, what are they going to do, extra spending money and those kind of things. So, I mean, there's a huge difference between some of those, for instance, ASU and U of A, than, you know, Scottsdale Community College or Phoenix College or, you know, some of those Maricopa County School District two-year colleges.
Mary Ellen, to wrap up, and you addressed this slightly, but I want to come back to this because obviously the reason I wanted to have you on is in response to the Phoenix College talking about at least eliminating the football program. And I know you said these are challenges that other member schools in the NJCAA face, but when you hear something, especially in a big city like Phoenix, the talk about getting rid of the football program, does that worry you?
It worries me to a certain degree because I think, you know, it's easy to say, well, you know, we need to make some cuts and let's do it with the athletic program. Although the NJCAA nationwide has not been able to do some research, we've had institutions who have done research that indicate for every student athlete attending a college, there is at least one and possibly up to 2.5 additional people that come to the college because that student athlete is attending. So to look at that program and say it's just a sport, it's just a student athlete and so forth, it may not be realistic when you talk about some of the other ancillary things that happen as a result of athletics, and that is, you know, those other people coming to the college to support, whether it be a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a brother, a sister, whoever it might be. And those are students that are typically paying all of their tuition and everything to go to the college. So I think there's some other factors involved. So it is worrisome in terms of, you know, whether or not that's going to set a precedent for other schools to take a look at. But it's worrisome also to not know whether or not the committee that made that recommendation fully understands the impact, both direct and indirect, that athletics has on a two-year college campus.
Mary Ellen Light is Executive Director of the National Junior College Athletic Association. Mary Ellen, thank you for the time.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
Take care. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. On January 8th of 2011, 19 people, including then-Representative Gabrielle Giffords, were shot by a gunman in Tucson. Six of them died. Some say Giffords is alive in part because of the quick actions of Daniel Hernandez, who at the time was an intern for the Congresswoman. Hernandez's story is now the subject of a play by ASU professor and longtime playwright Guillermo Reyes. It's titled They Call Me a Hero and is based on Hernandez's memoirs. Guillermo Reyes joins me now. Guillermo, thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
The book is, I mean, it's very intimate. There are a lot of important personal stories that Daniel Hernandez tells. Were you interested in him before the biography was published, when you heard about the actions he'd taken, or did you read the book and then feel an attachment there?
Yes, I was interested in all of the above. I mean, obviously the big event had a big impact on me, as it did on many other people in Arizona and across the country. But how to tell that in a play, I wasn't quite sure yet, but I had to think about it. And then last year, I believe you had Daniel on your show, and he was talking about his book. And so that's what I did. I got the book. I said, this would be a focus. Obviously, I heard of Daniel before that, but when I read the book, I found that it gave me the focus and the drama to be able to tell the story from a specific point of view. And his point of view, of course, is very interesting since he was declared the hero at the time. But he has a lot of things to say in terms of his childhood growing up in Arizona. It's a very intimate local story, but at the same time has national resonance. So I felt that it had what I needed.
When you think about hero, and I think he mentioned this in the past as well, that some called him heroic, not just for that action, but of course he also came out of the closet. He also declared himself publicly homosexual and was really involved in a lot of other things. When you think about his heroism, anything come to mind as far as the list? I mean, does the January 2011 shooting come to mind first? Is the fact how he's handled his personal life? What comes to mind for you?
I think he's handled it very well. And when he writes about himself in the book, he does mention all of these things. You know, growing up as a kid in Tucson, he was teased as being gay for reading the New York Times at 10 years old. And I thought that was an amusing little anecdote. But it gives us a sense of where he was. He was precocious. He learned emergency procedures in high school. And he was being called gay, too, because it was a classroom mostly made up of girls. When he volunteered for Hillary Clinton, it was mostly him and older ladies. So he was being teased as being gay from as a child. And so I thought that was interesting, because then the person who is then declared the hero has an interesting profile that is not what we would stereotypically call a hero. In other words, he is not, the muscle-bound guy who looks like Joe Manganiello from True Blood or someone like that. In other words, this is a young man from Tucson who's gay and Mexican-American, and happened to be well-versed in emergency procedures so that he was able to rush to the scene and help get Gabby the emergency help that she needed. And so, yes, I do think those actions are heroic, but they don't come from a stereotypically heroic person. So I thought that was a great part of the story, too.
Because you're an artist, let's talk about the creative process.
Yes.
When you're excited about a story, especially a real-life story, mm-hmm. How much creative license can you take? How much did you feel like taking with this piece?
Well, I did talk to Daniel about this the first time we met, and he's been awfully generous in letting me take some license, but I don't think I needed to. I think the story has a lot of drama in and of itself. It's in the book. Most of the play is something that I took out of the book. Now, in terms of dramatic license, I wasn't there when some conversations happened between him and Gabby, things like that. I definitely dramatized those aspects of it, and you know, he's approved of it, but he knows that it is a dramatized or fictionalized version of that. And so he's aware of that. Same with his family. I don't know what he and his family sound like at home, but as a writer, I have to project my playwriting capacity onto that. And so that makes it very interesting and challenging for a writer. I figure as long as I'm not making up horrendous things that are completely out of it, then I think he's okay with that.
At what point in this process of putting together a play like this, mm-hmm. are you able to say, okay, it's in the world now, there's only so much I can do, and how much do you feel like I want to grab that back and redo this?
Well, that's why I think it's good to do it in different places. I mean, we did a reading of it first here at the Arizona Latino Arts Center in downtown Phoenix, got some feedback. Then we did it in Tucson again at Borderlands Theater back in February, where I got some more feedback. And now we're doing it at Borderlands Theater as a production, and so I'm sure I'm going to get more feedback. And so I think it's good to go through certain types of steps where you get a lot of feedback and then see what the next step would be. I'm looking forward to continuing to work on this project, you know.
So coming back to the foundation of the play, in certain plays, it starts with a scene that perhaps we've heard of, especially in the case, obviously, of a real-life person. Mm-hmm. What's the foundation, if you wouldn't mind sharing, the foundation, the centerpiece that you feel like the rest of the play emanates from?
Well, I think it comes from that image of what happened on January 8th. What happened that day? What were the who were the people, and what were the step-by-step events of that day? And it comes down to the image of this young man taking control. I mean, he was such a young man at 21, and he was an intern. I'm sure that a lot of people felt that they were schooling him, and things, but he took charge. And I think that was the central image of the entire play, of how he managed to do that. And he wouldn't have done that, I think, without the education that he got, and without, I think, the self-education as well, because a lot of it is something that he promoted himself. He wanted to be reading the New York Times at 10 years old, And so there were a lot of precocious aspects in his growing up that I think put him in that situation that day. And so I think that, to me, is the central image of the story.
Playwright Guillermo Reyes, They Call Me a Hero, is being performed starting September 25th in Tucson as part of the Borderlands Theater.
Yes.
Guillermo, thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you very much for listening. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on today's program. Stay tuned for NPR's Here and Now. It's next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. If you want to hear any of this program and of our previous Here and Nows, you can either go to kjzz.org this afternoon or download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.